The United States and Israel are democracies, but there are fundamental differences in the way they go about the business of their political life. In this country, we elect the president directly. In Israel, he's elected by the members of the Knesset and must be one of its members. Here we elect our legislature regionally, the Senate by state, the House of Representatives by congressional district. In Israel, the Knesset is, of course, elected at large. Here we vote for individual candidates. In Israel, the populace votes simply for a party list. Now, these are well-known differences, but perhaps of greater importance, and certainly less well-known, is the fact that our country is governed by a written constitution, and Israel has no written constitution. This was not the original intent of the founding fathers. In November of 1947, when the famous partition resolution was voted on by the United Nations, the Jerusalem section of the Jewish Agency asked a noted jurist, specialist in constitutional law, Dr. Leo Cohn, to prepare a draft of a proposed constitution for the new state. Dr. Cohn worked energetically for a good bit of time. He prepared a draft consisting of a preamble and some 9 individual chapters for submission to the Provisional Council. And then his draft fell afoul of the lack of definition which had existed within the Zionist movement from the very beginning. The Zionist movement drew together all those who were convinced that there needed to be a national home for the Jewish people. But the various reasons that one group or another had for espousing this cause differed from the other. Their visions of the new state were quite different. Theodor Herzl, late in his career, published a utopian novel called The Alte Neuland, The Old New Land, in which he envisions what the land will be like once it is established and once the Jewish people are in place. And clearly what he has in mind is simply a land which will be settled by Jews, a land whose governance and whose economics will be very much like that of a modern Western industrial democracy. Judaism will touch this land just lightly. It will dust it with the Sabbath rather than with Sunday. Our holidays will be official holidays. But beyond that, the Jewishness of the Jewish state is hardly a matter of concern to him. On the other hand, that group within the Orthodox community, the traditional community which espoused the Zionist cause, had formed themselves into a group called the Mizrahi, which is an acronym for Merkaz Ruhani, a spiritual center. And their vision was clearly that of a modern state which would be shaped by and governed by a religious law, the Halakha, in which Jews would organize themselves in a way which was substantively different from the way in which Europe had organized itself, because it would be organized by principles which went back to the Bible and to the Talmud and to the rabbinic codes rather than by those things which derived out of the magisterium of the church and of the Western law. When Dr. Cohn submitted his proposal, there were a number of items there which reflected the general understanding which was shared by most of what this Jewish state ought to be, in what degree it was to be Jewish. The preamble affirmed God and thanked God for having brought Israel out of exile, for having reestablished the people in the Holy Land. It went on to say that the Sabbath and the holy days would be the legal holidays of the new state. It went on to require that the religious courts, which had been in operation during the mandate in the Turkish period and had authority in matters of personal status, should continue, although it also stipulated there would be a Supreme Court, which would have the power of judicial review. It argued that the law of the land should be essentially the English law, which had operated during the mandate period, but suggested that the legislation which would be passed by the new Knesset ought to be framed according to the traditional norms of the halakha, at least with the spirit of the tradition in mind. It provided for freedom of conscience and of religious assembly, but at the same time it said that the state was to be the national home of the Jewish people, and clearly, as you can see, envisaged a major role within that state for the developing spirit of our religious civilization. Once this document was submitted to the Provisional Council, a number of questions were raised from both sides. To some, the heirs of Herzl and the heirs of the more radical socialist movements of Eastern Europe with their anti-religious position, it seemed anathema that the rabbinic courts should be established as constitutional requirements. Many of them had no problem with the idea that for a period of time these courts should retain some degree of jurisdiction, but they didn't want to see this established permanently within the structure of the new state. Others were concerned that there be provisions for those Jews who did not want to submit themselves to the authority of the religious courts. The focus of the issue was that of civil marriage, rather than marriage only for Jews only within the context of the halakha. And these kinds of issues were of great concern on the left. On the right, there was a growing concern, even by those who believed that there ought to be a constitution, that the constitution ought not to frame as absolute values, values which ran counter to the tradition. And there were two main items which they raised of matters of concern. The first had to do with a prohibition, an absolute prohibition of capital punishment within the proposed constitutional document. And the second had to do with an absolute requirement for the equality of men and women. There was to be no gender gap in the new state. Now, rabbinic law circumscribes capital punishment very narrowly through a variety of means, and it was almost impossible in olden times for a Jewish body to, in fact, take a life through judicial procedures. Nevertheless, the Torah stipulates capital punishment, and the Talmud technically agrees. And the rabbis and others felt that the new constitution ought not to bring into question this kind of divine instruction, this Torah. And furthermore, the Jewish law traditionally is based upon the superiority of men over women in matters dealing with public policy. A woman's testimony is not accepted into traditional courts. But more than this, there is a general principle which Maimonides capsuled in his Mishneh Torah to the effect that kingship is not to be allowed to women, and this stipulates that in matters of public office, women are not to occupy such office. And clearly, the provisions of the new constitution ran directly counter to this traditional position. Now, the Mizrahi, who later became the National Religious Party, by and large, were willing to go along with the idea of a constitution, even though it contains some such provisions, provided that they were not framed in a way which seemed to disparage in any way the Torah positions. But there was also within the Orthodox community a largish group, powerful group called the Agudat Yisrael, groups of Orthodox religious leaders who had opposed from the very beginning the establishment of the Jewish state, both in Europe and among the older, more religious settlers of the land, on the ground that Zionism, the rebuilding of the state, was God's work and not man's, and we must not force the end. When the Messiah came, there would be time enough to have its own state. And this, the group of the Aguda Israel insisted that Israel should not have a constitution. Why? Because it already had a constitution. The Torah was Israel's constitution. And what we're saying in this connection was very simple, that Judaism, that the new Jewish state was not simply a state for Jews, but it was to be a theocracy. It was to be a state in which only one law was recognized, the halacha, God's law. Man-made law was to have no place in this new state. And by pressure, because the right in orthodoxy is always able to pressure the more moderates to come over to its point of view on fear that they will be challenged as somehow heretical in their views, as somehow reformist in their views, they were able to raise such such concern that after 2 years, the idea of establishing a written constitution for the new state was finally abandoned. And in June of 1950, a resolution was passed through the first Knesset, a resolution which was hailed then as a compromise. Israel would not now have a written constitution, but from time to time the Knesset would pass what it would stipulate to be basic law. And these basic laws would in time add up to a constitution. And of course the reason that Ben-Gurion and the Labor Party, the governing body in Israel, was willing to accept this compromise was one, that it was a face-saving device. Two, they really hoped that in time these basic laws would add up to a constitution. And of course, third and most important, they had been during most of this period under attack from the Arab states. The economy was in shambles. It had to get going. There were the thousands and tens of thousands were still languishing in the Ma'abarot. There was more urgent business at hand, Ben-Gurion felt, than to fight out with the Orthodox community, the most rigid within that community, the issue of the nature of the new state and the relationship of religion to public policy within the new state. And so the position which was finally announced was this compromise position, and he added one element to it, and that was that the religious position which had existed before the state would remain the status quo within the new state, which is to say that because the religious courts, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, had been given authority over the laws of personal status before 1948, they would retain that authority after 1948. And whatever had been the provisions which had to do with religion and public policy in being before 48 would remain in being until then. And this led to a number of anomalous situations within the activity of the new state. Public transportation had to cease on the Sabbath in those areas of the new state where it had not been permitted during the mandate period, but in Haifa and in other areas where it had been allowed to run, where the buses had been allowed to run during the mandate period, they continued to be allowed to run after the state was established. Now, once this status quo, non-constitutional position was taken, Israel was in a position where structurally, life could proceed. There is now a basic law which has to do with the organization of the Knesset, with the rights of the presidency, with the voting rights of individuals. But obviously, this crucial issue of the role within of religion and the state, of the synagogue and the state, was not dealt with and has not been dealt with. And because of this lack of definition, this lack of founding principle, the problems in this area which Israel faced in the 40s have been compounded as time has passed along. In the 11 Israeli elections which have taken place between 1948 and today, the religious parties have received in each of the elections between 11 and 12% of the total national vote. In none of these elections has any party received a majority of the seats in the Knesset. As a result, Israel has always been governed by a coalition government. Now, the parties differ in Israel on matters of foreign policy and matters of economic policy, of taxation policy, and the only group which is what we would call a single issue group, the only group whose issues are not economic and not issues of public or foreign policy are the religious bloc. And so they've always been the most desirable members to bind into your coalition. Because when Labour was in power, it did not have to abandon its support for socialist, Histadrut kinds of issues by bringing the religious parties in. When the Likud came in, it didn't have to abandon its other foreign political issues in order to bring the religious bloc into the government. And because of the importance of this bloc in forming any government, it has been able, through the usual mechanisms of bickering and negotiation, to gain for itself over time, one after another, a series of very important advantages, which it did not have, which in fact undid the original agreement that the status quo would remain. Thus, for instance, in 1952, it was able to gain from the Labour government the agreement that there would be no civil marriages in Israel, which in effect completed the authority of the religious community over the laws of personal status of those who did not want to submit to the courts in such matters. It was able over the years to gain control largely of two ministerial portfolios, two cabinet positions, that of the Ministry of Religious Affairs and the Ministry of the Interior. And in those two, and almost entirely over the years, those two ministries have come to be staffed with people who are of traditional political persuasion. And therefore, they've been able to control to a very large degree the way monies are spent. And in many of the bargains which were struck before coalitions, large sums of money, larger than would have been apportioned to other parts of the society, were poured into the religious institutions, the Orthodox religious institutions, the yeshivot, the kolalim, and other institutions of this type. The typical arrangement was the arrangement that was made when Mr. Begin came into power for the first time. There were some 85 provisions in the document which established that coalition government. 50 some odd dealt with the religious bloc and their issues. And in those various agreements, the Begin government agreed, one, to revise a law which dealt with autopsies, so that if any person in the family signed a document that didn't want the autopsy to take place, it could not take place, whatever the doctors might have had in mind. There was an item in there which said that in the having to do with an earlier law dealing with abortion, which very narrowly limited the ability of doctors to certify the need of an abortion for a woman, where heretofore had been done on rather broad medical and psychological basis. There was an item in this document which said that when traditional Jews come to Israel, special consideration are to be given to them in terms of settlement. Places are to be found for them in near areas which are traditional in their approach, that special monies are to be set aside for their resettlement and for their housing. There was an item in there which stipulated that increased amounts of money were to be given to the various Orthodox religious institutions, and that the government would not exercise financial oversight over the uses and expenditures of those monies. There was an item in there which said that Orthodox Jewish girls, when they were called up for the service, could be exempted from military service simply by stipulating on their own authority that they could not serve because of religious scruples. There was an item in there which guaranteed that the government would bring into the Knesset within a matter of time a law having to do with the revision of the law of return, which would have prohibited those Jews who had been converted by non-Orthodox structures, by Reform and conservative rabbis outside of Israel, from qualifying for entrance into Israel under the law of return. So what has happened over the years is that the political power of the traditional community in Israel has been able to affect the ways in which public monies are distributed, public laws are framed, and increasingly has turned what might have been, many of us thought would become a more Western-oriented, more open society in matters of such as abortion or autopsies into one which is much more medieval, much more rabbinic, old-fashioned, if you will. From the very beginning, the conflict was between those who stand in the tradition that laws are at best approximations of what a society can hope to achieve morally, spiritually, in terms of public safety at a given moment in time, and those for whom there is only one law, God's law, and obviously this law is not negotiable. And Jewish law, it ramifies into all areas of human life. Our tradition was self-governing for many thousands of years. And because of that, the Jewish tradition has had to deal with all kinds and areas and facets of Jewish life. And so whenever an issue came up, there was a traditional answer. It was traditional. But to many Jews in and out of Israel, it was not necessarily appropriate or, in fact, just. The first issue which emerged, in which conflict came about in a direct kind of way, had to do with attitudes towards marriage, towards all these rules of personal status. There's a judge of the now retired of the Supreme Court of Israel by the name of Chaim Cohn. Chaim Cohn's a fine jurist, a gentleman, a scholar, who in his middle life was in a position where he wanted to marry, but he was a Kohen. And by Jewish law, a Kohen may not marry a divorced woman. The woman he wanted to marry was a perfectly fine human being who simply had at one point been divorced. One of the justices of the Supreme Court of Israel had to go to Cyprus in order to be married. And we had this kind of unfortunate situation multiplied again and again and again. By Jewish law, a child of a marriage which is prohibited under that law becomes what they call is called a mamzer. Now, in our vernacular, we translate mamzer as bastard. But in Jewish law, mamzer is simply someone who is a product of such a marriage and who, by Jewish law, may not marry anyone who is not themselves a mamzer. In other words, may not marry back, quote, up into the Jewish community. Some years ago, there was a woman by the name of Langer in Israel. Mrs. Langer had been married in Europe. She'd married a Gentile who had converted to Judaism. She'd married him sometime before the Holocaust. They had been separated, as many, many, many people were during the Holocaust, and he was lost sight of. She survived. She came to Israel. In Israel, she met a man. They fell in love, and they were married. She thought her original husband was dead. They had two children, and the children grew up. And at some point, some 15 or 18 years after her second marriage, her first husband reappeared. And he didn't know that she had been alive, and suddenly they discovered one another. By Jewish law, these two children were now mamzerim. That is to say, they were prohibited from marrying normally within the Jewish tradition. Both the young people were now members of the Israel Defense Forces. They were fine, had fine careers, and they appealed to the rabbinic courts for release from this kind of disqualification. The courts refused to do so. And then, of course, as so much that happens in Israel happens, they appealed to their political leaders, and Moshe Dayan made a great fuss in the Knesset and public about it. And suddenly the chief rabbi, Goren, decided he had to do something about this or else they were in trouble. And so he hastily convened a Beit Din, and the Beit Din brought in these people, and they discovered that the original husband no longer had the document which proved that he had converted. And so they ruled on this specious basis. Though everybody agreed that conversion had taken place, they agreed that the first marriage had in fact not taken place. The second marriage was Mrs. Langer's first marriage. These children were legitimate, and everyone has lived happily ever after, except for those who care about the quality and the appeal of our Jewish tradition, to those who do not readily accept these rules and restrictions. Now, if we go back a bit, we remember that the first law which the State of Israel passed was a law of return. The law of return stipulated that anyone who was a Jew was to be granted admission to Israel. It grew out of the fact that during the 30s and 40s, all the doors of the world had been closed to us, and now there was to be a Jewish state where never would anyone be denied admission to the haven which was by right his or hers. It's a great law, but immediately an issue arises. Who is a Jew? Who qualifies under the law of admission? During the Holocaust, there were any number of people who lost all sense of their family, who could no longer prove that, as you must prove in Jewish law, that your mother was Jewish or that you had been converted to Judaism. There were many of those who came out of, who were separated from their families, children particularly, who had no knowledge of who their parents were, who could not prove that their mother was Jewish. There were many families where the mother was not Jewish. The father was. The families had been hounded and persecuted, their lives threatened, because in the eyes of the whole world, they were Jews. And now there was the danger that they would come and appear in Israel. And having lived as Jews and escaped as Jews and hidden away as Jews and had their lives threatened as Jews for 10 years or more, they would suddenly be denied admission on these grounds by the Jewish state. And then there was, of course, the danger which became a fact that if the religious groups were given control over the definition of the Jew, whole groups of Jews who one for one reason or another did not fit their very narrow approach to the issue might not be accepted. When the brown Jews, the Jews of Cochin, the B'nai Israel, applied for Aliyah to come from India to Israel, the rabbinate suddenly began to investigate, and they discovered that the B'nai Israel had remained Jewish for over many, many hundreds of years. But for the last several hundred years, there were no rabbis among them. They'd lost that particular capacity. And so, there being no rabbis among them, there was no one who could certify that the marriages that had taken place generations back were all kosher, although they had only married within their own community. And they began to raise noises as to whether, in fact, these B'nai Israel, who for 1,000 years and more had been Jews, were to be allowed under the law of return to be admitted to the Jewish state. And then there was the reverse kind of situation. According to Jewish law, you're a Jew if your mother is a Jew and if you have converted, or if you have converted. And even if you have converted to another religion, you remain technically a Jew because of the principle that Yisrael af al pi shechata Yisrael hu, that even if a Jew sins, he remains a Jew. And the famous case here was a case of a man named Brother Daniel. Brother Daniel was a Pole, the child of Jewish parents who had hid him in a Carmelite monastery in Poland when the Nazis had invaded the country in the hope that the child would be spared. They had been killed. The child was spared. The child was raised by the Carmelites. The child obviously appreciated the love and attention and became enamored of the church, and he became a monk. And for reasons that only Dr. Freud would understand, he felt that he could fulfill his mission as a monk only by going to the Holy Land and serving there. And then he applied for admission to Israel under the law of return. Now, you can be admitted to Israel the same way you're admitted to the United States, under quota systems and systems of naturalization. It's for Jews that the law of return exists. And this issue came before the chief rabbinate, and the rabbinate said, well, he's a Jew. Well, this was a little too much for the state itself to effect, and finally the case was taken from the religious court to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that an apostate was no longer a Jew, at least for purposes of the law of return. And from that moment to this, the religious parties in Israel have made one of the demands which they are pressing more and more. That the demand that in the laws of personal status, the decisions of the religious courts shall not be subject to review by the Supreme Court of the land. They are to be a parallel and totally independent system. They have not won that position as yet, but they are pressing and pressing strongly for it. Now, during this whole period, a number of things have happened. As the political power of the traditional community has become more and more visible, as more and more people have had to bow to their coercive power or find means such as going to Cyprus to be married to escape from that power. Those within the community in Israel who might have been moved now that they were in a Jewish state to come to grips with Judaism, to search out for a way of religious expression which would be satisfying to them, have of course been put off. And religion has a name as a political power in Israel, but not necessarily as a moral and spiritual power. And there are many leaders within the traditional community who have become increasingly worried by this fact. Worried by the fact that the emphasis on politics and on formalism, on the structures of traditional law rather than on its spirit, is increasingly defining the law in people's eyes in the narrowest possible way and making people forget what is at the heart of the Jewish experience, the spiritual light which burns there and burns there brightly. And so what we have seen in Israel, what we are seeing in Israel, is that power breeds corruption, that the religious institutions have been accused again and again of misusing funds which have been put aside for their purposes, that those who are of the religious persuasion have become more and more assertive in a physical sense of their rights and more willing to do all kinds of impossible things in order to assert them. There was the absolutely horrible experience this last year of traditionalist extremists or fanatics who went into a graveyard, a Jewish cemetery, and exhumed the coffin of a woman from that cemetery whom they claimed was not Jewish, and it was a desecration of a Jewish cemetery to have such a body in that place. They simply left the body rotting on the surface. There have been any number of incidents where extremists, fanatics among this traditional community, the Haredim, have gone into businesses in their areas which are run by non-Haredim, or into apartments in the area which are owned and lived in by non-Haredim, and torched these places, simply destroyed them. You may have seen a little article that appeared in the Jerusalem Post some few days ago, in which the mayor, Teddy Kollek, complained to the chief Ashkenazic rabbi of Jerusalem that about leaflets which had been distributed in the French Hill area of Jerusalem on Rosh Hashanah Eve, which called on the local people to avoid conservative reform synagogues as places of desecration, which had described the non-Orthodox congregations as alien growth which practice strange customs. Now, why did Mr. Kollek find it necessary to call the chief rabbi of Jerusalem to task for this pamphlet which carried his name? Pamphlets, by and large, come and they go and they disappear from importance. But there has been a year or two of urban violence in Jerusalem and elsewhere in the country, tolerated by some of the religious leaders, in which the Haredim have tried in one way or another to enlarge their turf, to impose by force their religious points of view. They have demanded, interestingly, of issues such as this. There is a concern in the traditional community that graveyards ought not to be in any way desecrated, although clearly they're at times some of them are willing to desecrate them. And so they have now demanded a complete control over the activities of the archaeologists of Israel. Archaeology, obviously, is digging in the earth. Occasionally you come across bones in a graveyard. And they have demanded again and again that they be allowed to have a veto power over wherever the archaeologists of Israel are going to carry out their research. And as part of that campaign, about 8 months ago, 10 months ago, they went on the Mount of Olives and they chalked up graffiti all over the grave of Sukenik, who was the great archaeologist of Israel of the 19th 20s, 30s, and 40s, the man who found for Israel the Dead Sea Scrolls and published their contents. There is an ugliness, an assertive ugliness, abroad in that community. It's not shared by all by a long shot. There have been a number of voices, particularly centered around Bar-Ilan University, which have speaking out as forcefully as they can against this emphasis on formalism, against the sense of separation and distance from the non-Orthodox community, against this feeling that their way is the only way and they will not compromise with those who follow another way. But the issue is a very difficult one, because as we have seen in Cleveland, whereas a generation or two ago, before Tel Shiur Yeshiva came to Cleveland, there was a much greater sense of cooperation between Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox rabbis and congregations than occurred when a group to the right of the perfectly traditional Orthodox rabbinate of Cleveland began to say, well, if you don't do it our way, you're somehow tainted by their way. Two generations ago, it was not at all unusual for one reason or another for non-Orthodox rabbis to be invited into an Orthodox synagogue to discuss this or that or the other thing. In the last 30 years, that's not happened. We are outsiders, michutz lamachaneh, completely beyond the camp. And increasingly, the pressure grows to turn Israel more and more into a community whose basic law, whose constitutional law, will in fact be the Torah. And one of the foci of this drive now is to complete the amendment of this law of return so that the law of return will read that a Jew is a Jew by virtue of their birth, that is, by virtue of their mother's Jewishness, or by virtue of conversion, kahalacha, if it is carried out according to the norms of the halacha. Now, one of the interesting issues here is that, by and large, the leaders of the religious parties in Israel have not made this particular change in the law a major item. Other items, yes. But this one has been pushed largely from America, largely from the Hasidim, particularly Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's been pushed because it is part of a program to continue the discreditation, the delegitimization of our Judaism. That is, all non-Orthodox Judaism. Because it's a way of saying that our ways are not acceptable. And that if somebody goes through a process of learning, of instruction with one of us, and we bring in, as we do, other rabbis to participate in the conversion itself, that's not a conversion at all. Nothing has happened. And that until one goes through the processes within the structures which the halacha permits, nothing has changed in that person's status. And what we're seeing then is a spillover from Israel to the diaspora of this sense that there is only one way in the house of the Lord and not several. And that one way is one which will be enforced in Israel and therefore will have its ramifications outside of Israel. Now, the victory of the traditional community in Israel in terms of its control of the laws of personal status is complete, which is to say that they within the last 10 years, they got the government to agree that although they would not change the law of return to define a Jew as one who has a Jewish mother or is converted halacha, in matters of personal status, that is, once you get into the country, all the rules are governed by the halakha, and that the religious courts need not give any credence to the documents which are the documents of entry. That is, you cannot say once you come into Israel, but Israel accepted me as a Jew under the law of return, and have that document have any standing in terms of your marriage relationship, in terms of your children's status, in terms of your own personal acceptance into the community of the Jewish people. That whole set of issues is now completely within the control of the rabbinic courts. Is there much chance for a change? The problem has gotten worse, obviously, and not better. The problem is not to try to create Israel as another version of the United States. We have different structures. the separation of church and state as it exists here was never intended really by anyone to be the sole measuring standard for the structures of Israel. Everyone accepted the idea that there ought to be some elements which are uniquely and specially Jewish within a Jewish state. It was not simply to be a state for Jews. But very few were, of us at least, were prepared to see the Jewish state become a recreation of the medieval Jewish community. We were unwilling to accept the importance, we aren't willing to accept this importance on form over substance. And increasingly within Israel itself, as it is within any church state, the power of the religious community pushes the ordinary Jew away from his acceptance of, his interest in, his support of the religious message and the religious mission. Still, there are those 12% of the votes. Still, there are the coalition politics. It was announced just this last week in Israel that the new Government of National Unity will table in the Knesset next month a ruling that would ask that the law of return be revised so that it reads conversion kehalacha. And we continue, therefore, to move in the direction of more and more complete control by the traditional community over the lives of the Israeli community, with more and more impact of this fact on our own selves. One of the greatest tragedy of all of this is that it need not have been. Had people been willing early on to create a written constitution, there would have been a body of law. There would have been a direction which the community could have found. It wouldn't have simply responded to political pressures and to the fanatical elements within a particular community. But that has not happened. And so what now? There have emerged from time to time groups within Israel committed to, they're called the Party of Civil Rights, the party of various parties of one kind or another, who are demanding that there be a revision, moving away from the approach which has been taken. But Israel's politicians are eager for office, they're eager for some kind of national unity, and they are unwilling to face the issue squarely. And so I'm afraid that, as always, there will be, whatever happens in Israel, some kind of spillover into the United States, into the Jewish communities here. There's increasing talk here and there and everywhere that monies ought not to go through institutions which are where monies flow, from whom monies flow into the more traditional institutions, and that there ought to be a separate fundraising mechanism to see to it that, in a sense, Reform and conservative Jews outside of Israel are not supporting those institutions which are undermining their status condemning their values in Israel. I would not like to see that movement grow into anything of significance, but it is clearly there. There's a growing sense of alienation between our two communities, a tragedy of the first order, because we need their strength and their insights, and they need our strength and our concerns. There is the real hope lies in those traditional leaders who have had in Israel the courage to stand up and to say to their own communities, Lo zu haderech, this is not the way. That in the confused and troubled world in which Jews find themselves, in which Israel finds themselves, we must be one and not two, not several. That there must be cooperation, that we can cooperate without demeaning ourselves, still living the kind of traditional life which is important to us. But we must have respect for those whose points of view are equally honest and who are equally committed to God and to the Torah tradition as we are. But unfortunately, the yeshivot in Israel and the religious systems, the separate religious system of the religious parties, has cranked out over the years a propaganda line which looks upon Reform and conservative Judaism as a form of a bastardized Judaism, of Christianized Judaism, of non-Judaism, which assumes that Reform and conservative rabbis are deliberately misleading their congregations for whatever reasons, for whom there is only one tradition, that which is Torah true. and by Torah true, they mean their tradition.
And they are standing in the way, in a strange and paradoxical way, of the development of their own tradition. Because there is within the halakha, there is within the traditions of Judaism, a process which permits change and accommodation and growth, a process of judicial review, not unlike the kind of judicial review which occurs in our own political system. But in the last years, in and out of Israel, because of the pressure of change and the challenges, the great challenges of the times, by and large, the rabbis have not been willing to come to grips with the possibilities within the law itself to really lift up women to a place of equal rank, with equal rights to that of the male-dominated world of medieval Jewry, to lift up the concerns of the community so that it would accept legitimacy of other approaches besides their own. That discussion really does not take place outside of very narrow circles. And because it does not, we have this unfolding tragedy which threatens division and separation, which has created division and separation, and which threatens to become worse before it becomes better. And I think one final word. We Jews in the United States are committed to the separation of the church and state because it is to our interest to do so. And every year or so, when a church-state issue comes to the fore, we rally to make sure that, as much as we can, we restrict the implications of the decision. The relationship of the church and the state in the United States is heavenly, even under this Reagan administration, to the position of the synagogue and the state in Israel. The degree of religious coercion which Jew is showing to Jew in Israel, we would find intolerable, un-American, if it took place here. And next time, before we mount our soapbox, and mount the soapbox we should, before we do, let's recognize that there is a mea culpa to be said, that in our own little state, in our own little world, we've hardly set the shining example that we would like non-Jews to abide by in their relationships to us and to other minorities here in the United States. Amen.